Abin. Okay.
You mentioned that everything changes all the time. You should observe that. What is the bit that you come back to? The steady one? Why does that change? What is that?
I'm not quite sure what you mean. What you come back to, the steady bit.
Maybe misunderstanding what we're doing. But if we're kind of observing or thinking now, we've got to keep back to the watching the breath. And there's a sense of something that's always stable there to go back to.
Okay.
Why doesn't that change? What is that?
You mean other than the breath? So the question, if I reframe it, okay. So the for those who didn't hear, the question is that the sort of basic instruction, so developing the simple knowing, so knowing when a thought, a sound, a sensation is happening, being able to return back to the breathing, which of course in itself is always a process too. It's always a process too. So in terms of the teaching on impermanence, actually it's not a teaching on impermanence, it's a reminder of something we already know, that there is nothing that stands outside of that. There's nothing, it would be hard to point our finger at anything that stands outside of that. Now clearly we are developing a quality of knowing which is hopefully more stable than the moment-to-moment changes within the mind, within the body, within the breathing. So what we are actually cultivating, I don't know if this answers your question or not, we're cultivating a quality of knowing, a quality of wakefulness, a quality of mindfulness, a quality of awareness, which is absolutely able to hold and accommodate all of those changes without being scattered and temperamental and all the rest of it, that has a certain stability. And that certainly is, one of the directions of the practice is to develop that stability of that awareness. Does that speak to your question?
I think so.
Okay. Yeah.
I've done quite a lot of walking meditation and sometimes I feel like I get it, but often I don't. And what I've started to do, which I've never had explained to me, so I don't know if your opinion is on it, is focusing on like one muscle group, like in the legs or something, and feeling into that, how it feels in terms of if we're meant to be in the body and aware of the body, is that helpful to be aware of different parts like the ankle and things and how it's moving, or is that not really the point?
You hear the question? No, I should repeat the question. It's okay. So it's all right. People have got your back. So the question is about the walking practice and feeling like beginning to done quite a lot of it and just beginning to get it. And is it helpful to be very, very specific in the focus? For example, on a particular muscle group like the ankles. What happens to the ankles in walking? I think, we need to look at skillful means. This is what we need to look at. There isn't a right way to do the walking. In times when the mind is more fragmented, more distracted, having a kind of more singular focus of mindfulness can actually be quite helpful because it's a much more precise anchor. Mm-hmm. So that can be just the contact of the foot in the ground or a particular aspect of the body that's involved in the walking. That can be really helpful in times when, particularly times when the mind feels more ungrounded. And this is true in our lives. And I always want to make the link between what we do here in formal practice and the rest of our lives. I mean, think of standing on a crowded underground platform. There's a million things that are kind of shouting at you to pay attention to, sounds, sights, people. And, it's not about blocking them all out, but it's aware of that capacity just to feel so scattered and so fragmented. Think of standing on that platform and feeling, either seeing wholeheartedly, listening wholeheartedly, or feeling my body touching the ground wholeheartedly. there's that sense of collectedness, and in a way that quite more precise focusing of attention, it's a kind of guardian of the mind. It's a kind of a guardian of the heart. It's found in that place where there's a genuine sense of connectedness and aliveness. There's other times when the mind might feel far more steady, far more spacious, quite collected. And you can feel that capacity of more inclusiveness quite naturally emerges. And it's not either that I feel like the world is shouting at me, nor do I feel like I'm pursuing the world at the moment for something to excite me. But there's just much more of a sense of inclusiveness. And that can change, many times in a single walking period. And it can change many times in a single day. And I think that's part of that listening inwardly is developing that skillful means of really knowing what is most helpful in this moment to feel most awake, most present, most connected, most mindful. Sometimes it's quite a singular focus, and sometimes it's a much more inclusive one. Yeah.
I think the way I'd like to carry on from that is for me, one of the biggest struggles and challenges I find is marrying this on the cushion and off the cushion, particularly when it comes to very, very powerful emotions, or in my case, or my daughter quite often, and how it's for me very difficult to get that moment that you're talking about when my emotions are being pressed, the button's being pressed, and staying in that moment so that I can then respond in a very peaceful, loving, calm way, which doesn't always happen.
Do you hear the question? I think this is a challenge for most of us, isn't it? We see how quickly we move into a world of impulse and reactivity, and how very vulnerable the mind can be in contact moments. I think a lot of what we do in practice is actually cultivating the inner conditions that allows us to know the difference between responsiveness and reactivity. It is really challenging because this is the most, it's kind of our most familiar, sometimes most habitual way of being, and sometimes the mind is very vulnerable for a lot of different reasons. Fatigue is a big one. I think it's hugely underestimated in our culture. When the mind is tired, it is vulnerable to reactivity. It's a simple equation. And it is a practice, and I think especially in human relational contacts, this is the place where reactivity most is triggered. I think there's a lot, we need to be very creative. This is not a one-dimensional prescriptive pathway. First of all, knowing our places of greatest vulnerability, our places of greatest impulsiveness, our places of greatest reactivity, that's actually really important. It's not hard for us to find them. We just need a little reflection in our life, and we know those places. So take the situation, if I can, if you don't mind, if I take it with, my daughter, someone I love dearly, someone who I also have the most charge about, okay? It's a classic one. We know that, okay? We know it. So I hear the door open. I hear the door open. What happens in that moment? Or I hear the phone ring. What happens in that moment? Or I hear the footsteps on the stairs. What kind of mode am I moving into? Is it apprehensive? Is it enthusiastic? Is it calm? Is it agitated? What kind of mode am I moving into? That's the first place of knowing, isn't it? Particularly teenage daughters particularly move most quickly into that place. Not always so, but you need to find your anchor. You need to find your anchor. You don't want to withdraw, be defensive. You don't want to be in the other extreme of being reactive. You need to find your anchor. Like right now when you sit there, you know, if you really pay attention, you can feel your hands together. In a way, you can choose what you do with your attention. You can choose what you do with your attention. And in a sense, it's almost like we need to build into our lives those anchors of remembering. You know, to get familiar with them. The anchors of remembering. The anchors that remind us what is possible for us in any moment and how to stay close to that. The body is wonderful in this. You know, when you listen to someone speaking to you, your daughter, how much are you in the body? How much are we not? How much am I able to find that anchor and rest there and listen from that place rather than listening from the place of what I'm already leaning into saying or feeling or reacting? How much can I listen from that place? How much can I speak from that place? You know, speech is often one of our most disembodied activities. It's like we're not here. We're just in the words. It's like, you know, I open my mouth and samsara jumps out. You know, it's like I'm not embodied. How much can I speak from that place of feeling that I'm still inhabiting the body? It's a lot of these places. It's about slowing down the process, isn't it? It's about learning to slow down that process from input to emotion to reaction to speech and action. A lot of this practice is about learning that we can begin to slow down that process. You know, because when we just get caught on that train, you know, and we get spit out the end of one of those journeys, you know, it often leaves such a lot of residue in the mind, doesn't it? Of, oh, I wish I hadn't said that, or I wish I'd spoken differently, or I wish I'd found the words. We just get, it leaves so many residues in the mind. And learning to slow down the process is a big part of what we're learning to do in practice. You know, and much of, you know, so much of this, you know, you think of the sort of reflections on wise speech, because that's usually how our emotions manifest, or one of the big ways that our emotions manifest is through speech. To learning to bring that into a more embodied action rather than an impulsive one. But slowing down the process is so huge. You know, and the body is such an ally in that.
Yeah. Can I just follow on from that? Because, I mean, I completely relate to it. And think about it a lot. And it's almost as if, for instance, as you say, speech can take me away from myself and my sense of the body. And it's almost as if I can only do one or the other. It often feels as if there's just kind of one focus. And so if I'm by myself, increasingly, I can try to remain fairly contactful. But if I'm speaking to somebody else, even actually if it's not conflictual, just the process of speaking and doing it, for instance, right now, will take me to focus on speech. That's very difficult. It's almost as if, I guess my question is, do you need to develop both and? Do you need to develop a capacity for being with the speech, which you have to be to continue, you know, some kind of coherent speech, even if you slow it down, whilst also trying to keep kind of split screen for yourself where you can also be in contact with bodies? Is it something like that? Because I find the endeavor quite difficult to get hold of.
I mean, I find it interesting that you frame it that way, and I think probably a lot of people would frame it that way, you know, that I'm aware of my speech, I'm aware of my body. Your body is speaking. That's the simple actuality. Our body is speaking. Our mouth is actually part of this body, as our vocal cords are, you know. It is our body speaking. I think what you're referring to is often when it feels like my mind is speaking. And that's the kind of separation that we make. And I think that's why mindfulness of the body is such a huge thing, because everything we do through the body, including speaking. And so how to actually don't feel like it's a split screen, but to actually feel like this is one screen. This is one screen. And it's a hugely challenging thing, because I think speech for many of us is probably the most impulsive domain of our life. Probably the most... I mean, it just seems to happen. And that's because the mind is... It's more as if we're located, as if the mind is speaking and the body has got nothing to do with this. In the reality is the body is speaking and the mind is shaping how that speech is forming. So it's not a split screen. And I say this, and I don't say it at all lightly, but to listen to ourselves speak from within the body. To not depart. It's when the momentum, I think, of the thought patterns are so strong, as in elsewhere in our life, that the body gets left behind. Somehow the poor cousin. But I would encourage you almost to take that as a mindfulness exercise into our lives. You know, what does it feel like to listen to myself speak as much as what it feels like to listen to another speak? To feel that from within the body, rather than it being, oh yeah, the body's doing something else. The body is listening and the body is speaking. And it's only the impulse of the mind that is actually creating that forgetfulness. So as a sort of daily life practice, you know, to actually be mindful of the body speaking, rather than being mindful of me speaking or being mindful of the mind speaking, being mindful of the body speaking is a hugely interesting exploration. To be mindful of the body listening is a hugely interesting exploration. And it becomes a doorway to how the mind is either engaging with the body or not engaging with the body. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it seems quite profound and challenging. There's a lot of space.
Yeah.
The talking, the chattering doesn't stop. Well, I don't know if it's the same for everybody else. The chattering, there is an inaudible chattering that goes on. I mean, even when I say I'm not going to react, there's a reaction that still goes on silently. And I come from an experience with a member of my family where I had a lot of clashes, where I didn't win by keeping my mouth shut, nor did I win by reacting. Well, I wonder if the Buddha actually considered that, because the teacher that I had always used to remind us, you know, that the chattering goes on, it never stops, even when you're dreaming. I don't know how you feel about this.
Well, I'm not entirely sure that the chattering never stops. I think this has something to do with... The time when the chattering, let me tell you how the Buddha put it, okay? Describing being the master of thought. Thinking the thoughts I want to think when I want to think them. Mm-hmm. Not thinking the thoughts I don't want to think when I don't want to think them. That simple. So... There's different dimensions of thinking, isn't there? There's intentional thinking, there's reflective thinking, there's investigative thinking, there's entertainment thinking, there's helpful thinking, there's unhelpful thinking. Now, a lot of the chatter is more in the realm of just... I think of it as kind of mastication, you know? It's just kind of chewing away. Maybe it's kind of chewing away on, his thoughts, you know, a lot of them, they're not particularly emotionally charged, they're just kind of benign, they're just kind of floating through. That can stop. It can stop, yeah. Yeah. I'd say it's quite well developed, but yes, that can stop.
Because at the moment, speaking away from sort of how it ought to be or what it should be, is that a tune keeps playing.
Yeah.
I think this is quite common.
It is quite common.
To some people.
Yeah.
But what this teacher of mine said, that the only time that the chattering stops in our sleep is when there is dreamless.
Yeah, deep sleep.
Because I understand that the Buddha was asked once, somebody wanted to challenge him, and said, when you're dreaming, even in the dreamless state, are you aware? Apparently he said yes.
Yes, he did. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you have to, I think there's a way where it's really helpful and I think quite encouraging to imagine the mind as the Buddha described it. You know, thinking the thought, wants to think when it wants to think it, not thinking the thoughts, doesn't want to think when it doesn't choose to think. And there's something quite profound and quite inspiring about that. It also feels impossible for many people, okay? So I think rather than saying, oh, well, that's the mind of a Buddha, no, that's the mind that is well trained. Okay? That's the mind that is well trained. Meanwhile, we have to know how to relate to the mind that is. Okay? Including the mind in its kind of extreme, obsessive, ruminative type of thinking that can be so gripping, to that much more moderate level of background commentary. You know, it's just kind of chuntering away. It doesn't feel particularly harmful, you know. But it feels like the ongoing buzz, you know, the ongoing buzz. And in a way, I think of it almost as like the hum of selfing. The hum of self, you know. I'm just sitting there in the background making sure everything's all right in my world, you know, or having a name for it or categorizing it. And on one level, it's quite benign, and it's quite useful to learn how that can just sit in the background of your attention, you know, like the sound of the wind in the trees, not something to get excited about, not something to, you know, get obsessive about. Just let it sit there, like the sound of the wind in the leaves. And that's a question of foregrounding and backgrounding your attention. So you're foregrounding, you know, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of breathing. I think it's helpful to do that. I think that's part of a training of learning to befriend the mind and learning to befriend the thought processes that can feel so impenetrable. But I also think it's not helpful to be too complacent about that and think, oh, well, that's just how the mind is, you know, it just buzzes away. No, the mind is not always like that. Sometimes it is, and sometimes the mind has a capacity for remarkable clarity and quietude and stillness. You know, the mind has a capacity for really intelligent and reflective and investigative thinking. You know, and so it really is learning to bring this domain of thought into the field of our practice, knowing what's helpful, knowing what's unhelpful. We develop the help, what is helpful. We learn actually to calm and to understand what is not helpful, including the chatter. And, you know, when the Buddha talks about it, you know, the mind is not a different mind when we're sleeping. It's just more disorganized. It's just more disorganized. So, you know, emotional themes that would often be more organized in a waking state just assume very bizarre and random imagery. But that too changes with practice, you know. And, you know, I see one of the big changes in practice is about choice. You know, it's about choice. You know, when we're awake and I see, you know, some repetitive, ruminative thought come along, I develop through mindfulness a choice about whether I'm going to jump on that train or not. You know, and learning the skillful means to be able to calm and to release it, and that capacity begins to transfer over into sleep states.
I've been doing meditation for a while as well, and
I can say that I had the benefit, the privilege, or whatever, of having those moments of clarity in meditation where I could see the thoughts coming, no energy or intention in thinking them, or emotions attached to that. But it's been a question growing more strongly in my mind. This clarity is wonderful, but I keep wondering, where's that coming from? What is it? And I'm still trying to find that.
The question about what is that clarity? It is clarity.
feels different. I don't know. I mean, it's.
But it only feels different because I think of its unfamiliarity. You know, I think when people practice and they begin to encounter a mind that looks very radically very different than the mind that they're familiar with, you know, a mind of spaciousness, a mind of calm, a mind of brightness, you know, of wakefulness. I mean, sometimes that mind, sometimes they can be states that are born of concentration. But I think, you know, and they're helpful and they're useful. And they're very encouraging. And they have very specific characteristics, okay, those kind of states of clarity. But I think they're helpful in the sense that they really give us a glimpse of really how the mind can be, how wakeful, how almost pristine, how bright the mind can actually be. And I think rather than trying to pin it down, you know, what is that? That is how the mind can be. And that's something to develop and something to naturalize and something to internalize. It's not something, you know, disembodied or external or esoteric. This is the potentiality of our minds and hearts.
And the other thing I kind of sort of tried to place it in here was the intuition. How you kind of say, oh, it's just the thought that the mind is coming up, or it's intuition and it's something that's probably worth listening to.
There's a lot of things worth listening to in our minds. In fact, I think everything is worth listening to in our minds, including the thoughts that don't feel helpful or, you know, the impulses or the obsessions, is still worth listening to. You know, I mean, I think, you know, in terms of understanding, in terms of wakefulness, it is why, you know, the Buddha so firmly placed this pathway in the classroom of our felt experience, including the classroom of our minds. And, you know, that just as a mind has a capacity for remarkable confusion, it has this capacity for remarkable insight also. You know, now, there's some, you know, we begin to discern the differences, you know. We begin to discern the differences. You know, when it's confusion, there tends to be a lot of narrative, you know. When it is more an intuitive, more insightful understanding, there tends to be less narrative and less doubt.
That's right.
Less doubt. Yeah. Okay, thank you. So